Good evening, everyone. You've tuned in to Paradigm Shifters, and boy, a lot of you are going to be excited about shifting through the paradigm that our guest has taken herself through in this lifetime and how much she's really lifting and supporting a lot of other people who might be stuck in the same divot. So welcome to our show, Esther Nicholson of Soul Recovery.
Thank you so much, Veronica. My pleasure to be here.
I'm very excited to talk to someone who's a backup singer for Rod Stewart and Bette Midler, because that's always one of my fantasies, is to be a good backup singer. But that's beyond. That's the other part of Esther's amazing journey from cocaine addiction and kind of being out of control, we put it mildly, into being a very, very powerful teacher of getting into control, right?
Well, I think that getting into control is an ego based way of being, which, you know, you eventually fail at that, and that doesn't give you very much happiness. So I wouldn't say control. I would say empowered.
Right.
You know,
okay.
Empowered through connecting to the power within me. Yeah.
Yeah. And your steps have been quite amazing. This book is essentially a 12-step book, but it's much more in-depth than many 12-step things that I've read.
Right.
Yeah, and I feel the presence, da-da, my favorite thing, in it all the way through. It's pretty amazing.
Thank you.
So,
thank you.
Yeah, so you talk about how... let me see now. How did you get into doing the drug thing? Was that a loss? Was that a huge loss in your world?
Well, you know, addiction is so much bigger than the manifestation of the addiction or the symptom of the addiction. The cause of all addiction is based in the false belief that you're separate and apart from your wholeness, God, spirit, or whatever. And from the time I can remember, you know, I've always had that disconnection, or I had that belief in disconnection. And as a result of that, I was addicted to low self-worth and low self-esteem and, you know, terrified of abandonment and rejection, thus always drawing that to me based on the perfect law of attraction.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of disconnection created within me, and I believe creates in others, you know, this insatiable hunger for anything external to myself. And so that hunger manifested into drugs, alcohol, relationships, unhealthy relationships. Healthy relationships or unrelationships. I mean, so many people can relate to being addicted to having to be in a relationship, or even when they're in a relationship, they're obsessed about the glory of it,
mm-hmm.
or they're obsessed about the distress of it,
mm-hmm.
you know. So
or obsessed about the identity because of it, sort of thing.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the beginning of my journey into addiction, was first the disconnection from my wholeness, and then those negative life draining beliefs of not being enough and not belonging and low self-worth, which I know that everybody on this planet can relate to in some form or another.
Yeah, it's interesting because you say low self-worth. I feel like so much of our life is how we compare to everyone else anyway, isn't
mm-hmm.
it? And mm-hmm. they have and I don't, so that I'm not okay. Is that right? Would you say that?
Absolutely, and it's an illusion.
Mm-hmm.
It's an illusion, but just like Bill Wilson says in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, the alcoholic mind cannot differentiate the truth from the false. And just like the alcoholic mind can't differentiate truth from the false, the unillumined mind, the unawakened mind, cannot differentiate the truth from the false. So even though low self-worth is an illusion and it's blasphemous, considering who we are as expressions of God, it feels very real when you're in it. You know what I mean?
Well, you're using a good word called feels, because our emotions very often run how we behave. And I noticed certain parts of the book I kind of related to, that I often think about how, where we've been abused, for example, we get a hardness or a coldness inside of us, don't we, emotionally? And then we don't make decisions based on being alive in our divinity, but more or less just being frozen or something.
Well, you know, I guess that's independent of each individual. I've never looked at it as being hardened or frozen, but we definitely all have our defense mechanisms to protect ourselves from being hurt. And in the attempt to protect ourselves, we act out, you know, mm-hmm. and I call that the inner child, the wounded inner child. And when a child is wounded, it either becomes aggressive, overly aggressive, selfish, dishonest, self-seeking and afraid, or it withdraws into itself. And so that's what we do, not because we're bad people or horrible people, or can ever be separated from the love of God, but we can certainly believe that we're separated from the love of God and act out from that place.
Mm-hmm. I guess when I say hardness or coldness, I go, a lot of times people will go, well, nobody really cares anyway, so I'm just going to do what I want. Or we get rebellious against unfair authority or whatever it is, right?
Yeah, that's just fear protecting you. You know, you're that part of your ego that is forgotten, that it's protected and loved and adored. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the way we protect ourselves. How wonderful it is when you can drop that and know that you don't have to protect yourself, that you are safe just because, you know, you are one with the divine.
Now, Esther, when you're little, or how do you experience this? Do you feel like as little people, because I know when you were small, you wanted to be a singer, but as mm-hmm. little people, don't you think most of us have clues about being divinity or being who we really are and who we want to be, being powerful? Don't we have those snippets going on as small people?
Absolutely, because I think that we're closer to the memory. You know, we haven't quite forgotten, we haven't been as conditioned to forget and to be brainwashed into the illusion of separation. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when I speak to teenagers and I speak to children, I say, I want you to try to remember that time, you know, when you would do cartwheels in the middle of the grocery store and you didn't care what anyone thought.
No.
You know, you'd be out to dinner with your parents and you'd be playing underneath the table, you know, with somebody's shoestrings or something, and you were just having fun, or you would sing, you know, at the top of your lungs, or you'd go up to strangers and say, "Hi, mister, my name is whatever," because you were free, and you were not conditioned to believe that you were not safe, or that you were ugly, or you were fat, or you were stupid, or you weren't enough. But someone lied to you. If it was in kindergarten or preschool, someone lied to you and told you, misidentified you, and you believed it, you bought it. And the more you bought it, the more you started to demonstrate it. And the more you started to demonstrate it, the more you bought it. So, you know, it's like one false belief piled on top of another. But yes, there was definitely a time, you know, when you didn't know anything about being broken or having any sense of unworthiness. There was a time when we all knew exactly who we were created to be.
And to be playful with this, when you knew when you were little that you really wanted to sing, but you got daunted mm-hmm. by experience, right?
Absolutely.
But I think that, I don't want to spoil the story. I think we should get into some of your story. But when you got recognized for, this is after not singing for a long, long time, when you got recognized in a group of beings for being a singer, would you say it's just like that radiance that was like you were beginning to emerge, that inner child was beginning to feel capable of expressing her real self, and so it began to be recognized in the world? Would you say it that way?
Absolutely, and I think that happens for all of us. But the more we wake up to the truth of who we are, and that story that you're talking about, I was starting to wake up from a very deep sleep of being separate and apart from my magnificence and my wholeness. So I was starting to wake up. And when you start to wake up, as I started to wake up, other people started to wake up around me and see me, because I was starting to see me.
See who the real you was.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's very exciting. So tell us a little bit about your journey. I know you had a child very young, didn't you?
Yeah, I had my daughter when I was 17 years old. And, you know, she is the byproduct of, you know, one of the deepest addictions I've ever had, and that was the addiction to feeling wanted and loved in all of the wrong places. And, you know, I was 16, and I hooked up with this 21-year-old army guy and who showed me some attention, and I thought I was, I was in heaven. And I was uneducated about sex and uneducated about my magnificence and my wholeness. And, you know, I did what most teenagers do when they're looking for love in all the wrong places. And I wasn't counting on getting pregnant. I just wanted to feel like someone loved me. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to, you know, and I wanted to experience sex, you know, but when you're uneducated and uninformed about those things, you pay the consequences for that. And of course, you know, we look at what appears to be our biggest mistake, and it turns out to be the biggest blessing we've ever had, which my daughter is. Mm-hmm. But yes, I got pregnant at 16, had my daughter at 17. So my daughter came into this world to a mother that was unprepared on all levels, spiritually, emotionally, physically, and financially. And she suffered as a result of that.
Mm-hmm. And how is she doing now? Has she been able to walk the steps with you, or is our individuality so entrenched?
I believe for my daughter that because she's been raised around recovery, that she definitely has the awareness mm-hmm. of her wholeness, and that she is still wounded in a lot of ways. And as her mother, I can take responsibility for a lot of that woundedness. And I can expose her to the tools for her healing, but her actually picking up those tools is her responsibility and her spiritual journey. And I just love her unconditionally, mm-hmm. and I stand in the gap, awaiting for her to return to her magnificence.
And I guess she chose. I mean, we all believe in this way of thinking, anyway, that she chose to come through for the experience, didn't she, or did she?
Absolutely. Yeah. Just like I chose to come through my abusive mother,
yeah.
and my dysfunctional family, who were perfect vibrational matches for me when I came into this incarnation. You know, there are no mistakes.
I know. Well, you know? And your father was a minister. What kind of a minister was he?
My dad was a Baptist minister.
Oh my! Hey.
Yeah.
But mm-hmm. now, he crossed over before you grew up, right?
Yes.
And that
yes,
must,
he
that,
made his transition before I grew up.
So that must have been a really devastating event for you as well.
It was the most devastating event I've ever been through in my life. Mm-hmm. It was soul, I don't want to say soul crushing, because we know that the soul can never be crushed. Mm-hmm. But it was definitely one of my deepest karmic experiences, I think, mm-hmm. That I've ever had, because he was the love of my life. He was the only parent that showed me that I was emotionally bonded to, mm-hmm. and I was 5 months pregnant when he died.
Oh my!
So the level of feeling alone and abandoned and unsafe was just, you know, so out there. I was so out there, you know, and so it was a very difficult time for me.
I bet, hey. And so when did you get into your cocaine addiction, or was it cocaine and alcohol and relationship? Is
uh-huh,
that what you
uh-huh.
said? How old were you
yeah.
then?
I was 22 when I got into cocaine addiction.
Okay.
And when I first took the first hit of cocaine, I thought I was in heaven. And that's the illusion, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that you're in heaven, that you have confidence that you never had prior to that, that you're more beautiful than, you know, you've ever imagined. and because it gives you that temporary feeling of gratification and confidence, yet it is it's so temporary, and the high goes away so quickly. You know, by now you've set off not only the, you know, it's based on a spiritual malady, a mental obsession, but you've set off the physical allergy now. So even when you say, I don't want anymore, you set off something chemically in your body mm-hmm. that says, well, you're not done until I say you're done.
Mm-hmm. Your description of how it hits the body was very gripping to me. I've never heard it. I've never read it described so I guess I'd say poignantly. I mean, I really could feel it as you wrote it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That was really marvelous. Yeah.
And if you think about it, you know, Veronica, that's not the only time I felt that sensation in my body, just, you know, around cocaine. I felt that around shopping. I felt that around, you know, the guy that I was obsessed with who's, you know, on the telephone. And so anyone that can relate to addiction and you take the drugs and alcohol out of it and put whatever and replace that word drugs and alcohol with whatever it is that you're addicted to, your body reacts the same way.
That's true, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Wow. Your hands shake, your mouth gets dry or watery, you feel like you're getting ready to have diarrhea. It's the same sensation.
Wow.
So I haven't had a drink or a drug in my body in 26 years, but just, you know, last year, I remember experiencing an obsession with the emotional aspect that I was going through at that time, and I experienced that same sensation. That's how I knew I wasn't over what it was I was recovering from at that time.
Well, can we get over these things? Because obviously they're triggered at some subconscious mm-hmm. level or some mm-hmm. childhood level. Mm-hmm. Can we actually get mm-hmm. over it, or is that a big dream? You know what I mean? Is it a lifelong process? Yeah.
I believe that you absolutely can recover, and in fact, that's a promise in the 10th step of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. You absolutely can recover. And as far as drugs and alcohol are concerned, I'm around alcohol all the time, and it's just not on my radar. Hmm. You know, it's just not on my radar anymore that, you know, when I receive checks in the mail or whatever, that, oh, my God, that thing happens to me, and I got to go get a hit of cocaine. It's just not a part of my vibrational frequency.
But did you also do alcohol as well as the cocaine?
I was never an alcoholic. I did drugs alcoholically. I did men alcoholically. Uh-huh. But alcohol was never my thing. I'd have a couple of drinks and I'd want to go to sleep. Or if I was trying to abstain from cocaine, but I still wanted to get a little buzz, I would have a couple of drinks. And then I was like, well, screw this buzz. I want to go get some cocaine. So, you know, so it was never the kind of, you know, I never drank alcoholically where that was the thing that I chased.
Yeah.
But it's the consciousness behind all of it, isn't it? Yeah. That when you have to drink for the effect, you have to drink to anesthetize yourself or you have to drink to feel good, it doesn't really matter whether the substance that you're going for is wet or dry.
Mm-hmm.
Or emotional.
Yeah.
It's the same thing.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So how long did you do that before you started with your recovery? And did you start with your recovery more than once?
My actual drug addiction, it was intense and it was demoralizing and it almost killed me. And it was blessedly short. You know, I started doing drugs, hard drugs, at like 21 years old, and I got sober when I was 26.
Oh, that's not and, too bad, is it?
Yeah, and I believe that everything that I've been through has led me to this moment. You know, that it was almost like it was my journey to have that very short but intense experience so that I could be the teacher that I am today.
Well, you're certainly quite the teacher. I love this book. I don't know if you'd be willing. Can we go through like a little snippet of each of the steps?
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah. So when you got started, then you had to really surrender, right?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to tell people, you know, I have a couple of clients who are very discouraged because, you know, they've been trying to get sober for 2 and 3 years, and they're like, I keep relapsing. And I talk about it in the book. You know, it took me like 2 years to get 30 days, you know. So, but I wasn't ready. But when I was really ready, and I was really ready to go to any length to do whatever it was I needed to do to have the life that I was created to have, I surrendered with my entire beingness to the spiritual aspect of recovery. Mm. That became my life. I wanted to know God, and I wanted to know my oneness with God more than I wanted anything else. And I was willing to do whatever, by whatever means necessary, I was willing to do that.
So it's a very transcendent, like a trance-like experience, a very ecstatic experience, was it?
When I had my spiritual experience, it was totally blissful and fourth dimensional and all of that. It didn't make the challenges in my life go away, and you know, I still had to face my emotional and deep woundedness and all of that other kind of stuff, but I definitely have been transformed. I was definitely a different person, which is what a spiritual experience will do.
Right. It's like having a near-death experience or something.
Mm-hmm.
So you had
mm-hmm.
to start and hand it over to higher power, right? You had to hand it all over. And step number one, a person has to really hand the reins over, right?
Well, in step number one, it says we admitted we were powerless.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that was the first step, you know, when I first really decided to recover, I had to really acknowledge that step and really take it within my soul that, you know what, you have promised a million times that you would never get high again. You have thrown away, I don't know how many dollars worth of paraphernalia saying, I'll never do it again. You have made so many false promises to your daughter that you would never do it again. And you can't not do it again no matter what. So in looking at my history and knowing that no matter what, I could not do it. I could not do it.
But your whole thing, all the way through the book, the whole thing is stepping away from or not buying into your history. That's the big job, isn't it?
It's not buying into your history. It's about getting a different perspective about your history.
Okay.
You know, you can't deny your history. You know, you can't deny the pain and you can't deny the experiences, but you definitely want to transform the story. You know, and you get to transform the story by doing the deep inner work and healing, allowing those deep core wounds to be healed.
So did it take you a long time to deal with step one? You see what I mean? Did it take more than like a long time?
I think that, you know, that in our lifetime, that we're going to have a million step ones,
okay.
You know, in different areas in our lives. I just dealt with step one. It wasn't about drugs and alcohol, but it was about the other issues that were, you know, that were on a deep core level. Mm-hmm. So when I finally got step one, as far as my drugs and alcohol is concerned, when I got it, I got it.
Hmm.
Which allowed me to go on to step two, which then allowed me to go on to step three. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, so let's talk about step two,
Step two, mm-hmm. well, first of all, if you don't mind, Veronica, I want to talk about step one.
Oh, I'd
because,
love to. Mm-hmm.
You know, step one says I'm powerless and my life has become unmanageable. But key one in my book talks about reconnecting to that inner power, where you are no longer powerless. You are now empowered, and your life has been restored to divine and perfect order.
Okay.
And step two of the recovery, the 12 steps, says I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. And in key number two, it says, well, you can't be restored to something that you never had. So it's reminding us that, yes, there was a time in your life when you knew that you were whole, perfect, and complete, when you knew that you were amazing, but you forgot. But you can be restored to that. You can be restored to that innocence. You can be restored to that confidence. You can be restored to that freedom. And that the power greater than yourself that can restore you to that is not up there, out there, over there somewhere. It's within you. It is you. It is the truth of who you are.
It's our divinity.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So do you have any stories about restoring yourself to wholeness? I like the way, I'm sorry that I wasn't acknowledging that you made a clear distinction between the way that the initial AA steps are written and the way you're writing the keys. It's very
right.
Different. Yeah, it's much richer. It's much more multidimensional, I guess.
Well, it's an expansion. It's an extension of the 12 steps.
Mm-hmm.
But I want everyone, your listeners, to understand that the 12 steps alone, as they stand alone, are very powerful. Mm-hmm. And it was important that I went through those, you know, before I created the keys, you know, so that I could expand on them and I could extend them, you know. But in my first days of getting sober, I really needed those steps. Mm-hmm. But there came a time when they stopped working for me because they are designed to only take you to a certain level. And so that's what inspired me to go deeper into my own spiritual work and practice, and then inspired me to develop a work, a spiritual practice that could serve the planet.
Mm-hmm. Yes, because I know a lot of people that object to I'm powerless, and I love the way mm-hmm. you've handled that. That's beautiful, actually.
Yeah, and do you understand, Veronica, that, you know, even 27 years of sobriety or in your life, that there are certain growth spurts, there are certain pivotal times in your life where you're powerless again.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a wonderful place to be. It's a wonderful place of humility to say, of myself, I don't know what to do about this. Mm-hmm. Of myself, you know, I don't have any power over this. And that's great, because now that opens the way, that gives you the humility to surrender to the power greater than your five senses, mm-hmm. to the infinite power that is within you. So, you know, we don't ever want to ignore that step, because, you know, I might go through that step at least two or three times a year in certain areas of my life. But what it does is but I know that I don't have to pull over and park there. That's the difference.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that step that gets me moving in the direction of the real power within me.
How many times have you gone through the steps so far?
I go through them every year. Yeah.
Good for
yeah.
you. Wow, that's yeah. wonderful, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm in the middle right now of a fourth step, fourth key radical forgiveness inventory in my own life. It's like, oh, okay, you know, I've gotten a little backed up here. You know, I've got some resentments going on. I've got some energy happening here that feels incongruent with my freedom and my wholeness. Let me get down to the nitty-gritty. Let me do some work. And that is why when I deliver this to audiences, when I sit in front of a client, that what I speak has such depth and weight, because I work it. I mm-hmm. do it.
You because, climb right in there.
Yeah. I'm. Mm-hmm. I, you know, so it's not like, you know, I've written a book and I don't know what's in the book anymore, because I'm so far removed from it other than promoting it. Mm-hmm. It's like I actually practice what's in my own book.
Yeah, I love that. Well, also the thing about always, like, for example, resentments, don't you think that so many life experiences triggers an awareness of things that have been locked somewhere in the vault of yourself? Or do you think it's repeated, a resentment that comes up again that you've thought you've cleared?
Well, it's not really the resentment that comes up again. It's the core wounds that created the resentment in the first place.
Oh,
and there are different layers of those wounds. And the wounds, you know, I call abandonment, rejection, betrayal, feelings of unworthiness, undeservingness, not enoughness, shame, feeling unloved, unwanted, insignificant, unsafe, powerless. Those are core wounds. Those are core wounds. And so we'll heal a layer of those,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll, you know, do the work which allows us to release the person that we've been holding resentment towards from blame, or from blame of our pain and accountability of our wholeness. And then we go on in life and all is cool. And then someone else will come along that will rip the Band-Aid off the next layer of those wounds.
Yeah, that's
you know,
sure.
And that's good, because that's just showing you that, oh, there's another layer there that needs to be dealt with.
So give us.
So we can look at that as a blessing, mm-hmm. you know, instead of a horrible thing. That's a blessing. You know, every mm-hmm. time someone mirrors back to me what's really going on with me, you know, after I say a few choice words.
But you let yourself yeah. do that, do you?
After I say a few choice words and do a few interesting things with my fingers, I usually I'm like, oh wow, thank you, spirit. I give thanks that this is revealed to me. Oh, this is what's been blocking me.
Okay.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
But what you just said reminded me that we do get to have our personality and all that. You can be a human being as well.
I'm all about it, Veronica.
Yeah.
I am all about it. I am all about being a spiritual being in a human incarnation, and I don't do a bypass on any of that stuff. I have my tantrums. Mm-hmm. I do interesting things with my fingers, and some choice words may come out of my mouth, and then it's like, and all the while I'm doing that, I know that there's a truth that is operating within me that I must get to.
So then when you go there, do you go to the person that you resent? What do you do with that?
It really all depends. You know, if it's going to serve all concerned, or if it's necessary, sometimes it's necessary to go to that person and say, you know, once I've done the work on it, you know, so sometimes it's necessary and sometimes it's just necessary to do an energetic mm-hmm. releasing of that because it's not about them at all. It's about you.
So is your mother still living? Asking about like an abusive situation, is your mother still living, and have you approached her?
No, my mother is not still living. But I've done several forgiveness inventories on my mother, and I'm about to do another one because mm-hmm. I noticed another layer of stuff coming up mm-hmm. that I wasn't aware of, and so now that it is, it's like, oh, okay, well. Before I teach my next forgiveness workshop, I need to deal with this next layer.
I notice you make reference to Colin Tipping. I love his radical forgiveness stuff. We have interviewed him.
I love it. I absolutely love his work.
Yeah, and you seem to have that kind of the same thing, that we have relationships that are in our soul's journey or way in our core. That's what he mm-hmm. would talk about, right? You want to mm-hmm. talk a bit about
absolutely.
That?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the difference between traditional forgiveness and radical forgiveness is traditional forgiveness says, you hurt me. You know, it's because of you that I feel abandoned, rejected, abused, shamed, you know, forgotten, whatever. But I'm going to try to forgive you. I'm going to mm-hmm. forgive you. And what happens is 2 minutes later or 5 minutes later, you're just as pissed off as you ever were, right?
Right.
Was.
Right.
And so many people, like, really set their intention to forgive, but they find that they can't. And the reason that they can't in traditional forgiveness is because I'm still blaming you for my pain, and I'm still holding on to the same story. And from that perspective, it's impossible, no matter, you know, how pure your intention is, it's impossible to forgive from that place. Mm-hmm. But radical forgiveness says, I feel hurt, I feel shamed, I feel rejected, I feel unwanted, I feel unloved, but it's not because of you that I feel this way. It's because I feel this way. This is my dominant thought pattern. These are my core wounds that I drew you into my experience. And so that takes the power out from out there and it gives it back to you. Mm-hmm. And it supports you in renegotiating your spiritual agreement that not only that you have with that person that seemingly hurt you the worst, but you get to renegotiate your spiritual agreement with abandonment, with rejection, with all of those core wounds, because our spiritual agreement is more with that way of being than with the person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we get to, in the fourth through the ninth key in my book, we get to renegotiate those agreements with our own soul, with our own karma, you know? And so that's how I've kind of laced radical forgiveness into my own work.
Yeah, I really love that. And when you said your own karma, I'm going, yeah, because somewhere deep down, it was a contract or our own choice to bring in that kind of conflict, right? Or that.
Right, and once you're aware of it, and once you have the spiritual tools and have reconnected to the divine, you can renegotiate that contract. You can say, you know what, I don't need this anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I send you back into the nothingness from which you came. You're not true. You're not the truth of me. Here's the truth of me. And then you talk about yourself from the aspect from you know, your oneness with God.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's very powerful work, mm-hmm. Veronica. Yeah.
It is. It really is very, very exciting. And I felt the energy shift all the way through as I was reading the book. So I hand
that's
that
so
to you.
Awesome.
Very transformative, you know. So I'd like you to talk a bit more about forgiveness, because you did talk about sometimes you go to the person and which one is that? Is that four? That's five, isn't
that's
it?
That's when you make amends. That's a nine.
That's nine, yes. That's a pretty tricky one, isn't it?
No, it's not tricky at all. If you have done the work from keys one through nine, mm-hmm. and you are now able to get quiet and be with someone who is on the same path that you're on and who's a little clearer than you are, and you know, you have this person that you need to make amends to, you get to discuss that, and you get to go within and say, you know, is this a dangerous situation for me? Is this going to cause more harm than good for me to go to this person? Or is this really necessary for me to go to this person? And so that you get clear, because in your oneness with the divine, you have spiritual discernment. And you want to, you know, make sure that you're not going to a person to make amends to just unload yourself of guilt. Mm-hmm. And while you're doing that, you're causing more harm, you know? But that you're actually doing it and you're cleaning it up.
And it doesn't matter, you know? Which key you're on, is you're deepening, you're being conscious of our own motivation is a big important factor, isn't it?
It's very important to be mm-hmm. that microscopically honest with yourself.
That's a lifetime process, don't you think?
It's a lifetime process, absolutely, Veronica. You know, like I said, I'm just coming through some stuff that it's like, whoa, little girl, I didn't know that you were still hurting like that.
Wow.
And, okay, I got you. Okay, we know what to do about this. I got you. And God's got us. All is well.
But it's interesting because you referred to karma, and I'm going, well, sometimes it's like an intricate mammoth number of things that are in there, reactions, uh-huh. responses, beliefs, and all that, isn't there? I mean, it's huge. Uh-huh. Not just from this
life. Yeah, but the beauty is we don't have to figure all that out. Mm. I don't have to figure that out. That's too much work. Mm-hmm. Not only is it too much work,
you get lost in it.
You can't uh-huh. from your, you know, you can't figure out the solution from the level of the problem. You know, so what I, you know, through prayer and meditation, and knowing that God is in those aspects of me that I'm aware of and those that I'm not aware of, that those places that I'm aware of and that I'm not aware of, even now I'm coming into realization and awakening. You know, so it's like that just takes the whole burden off of me of trying to figure anything out. You know, I don't want to figure anything out. I want to know the truth.
Yeah.
And the truth is that I'm whole, perfect, and complete. That's what therapists are for, or to keep you in a story of what happened. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't care about what happened. I mean, I think that that has its place, but then it just serves to keep you a victim. You know, you want to move forward into, okay, that happened. But what's the real truth about right now? Who am I? I am an expression of life. And life is perfect. And life is good. And life is love. And it is expressing as me.
And the word victim becomes obviously an adaptation to the identity that comes up when things go wrong, as opposed to being uh-huh. whole and perfect, right?
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
I found myself chewing that word all the way through the book, going, oh, yeah, okay. It's got all the words seem to get a different meaning when you're finished with them in this book.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a more expanded reality, I would
say.
Yeah. So what happens when you take... Oh, I guess I want to ask a number of things. One is, if somebody is really struggling with addiction of any kind right now, what do you suggest that they start with?
Looking at how many promises they've made to themselves to not do that addiction again. And they look at it from every angle. And to really, from a place of being really honest with themselves, ask themselves, do I have the power to not do this thing? Could I not do this? And if they're coming from a place of real honesty and look at the harm that addiction has caused, mm-hmm. to themselves, financially, spiritually, emotionally, and to the people around them. And it's from that place, do you want to continue to live this way? Is this quality of life acceptable to you? Just start with that one question. Mm-hmm. And if the answer is, I don't want to live this way anymore, but I don't know how not to, then get soul recovery as quickly as possible, you know, sign up for the classes, get to a meeting, you know, even if my way of helping is not for you, find some help, because when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. Mm-hmm. And if you are really, really, really ready, then the help that you need will be revealed to you.
And can people sign on to your website in order to get that kind of help?
Absolutely. They can sign on to the website at soulrecovery.org. They can download the first two chapters of the book and see if that's something that would work for them.
But I think, do you recommend people actually go to classes as well, or get meetings is what I'm trying to say here?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think that it's important to be around people that are like-minded, that are seeking to heal from the same thing you're seeking to heal from. You know, and in addition to that, I really suggest Soul Recovery, because I don't think that you have to wait for 10 years like I did to find out that you're worthy and that you're one with God. Mm-hmm. So I think that in conjunction with the meetings that we want to, you know, you can start off at a different level than I did and that so many other people have.
Mm-hmm. How did you finally get, would you say your life changed when you got to Agape? That's the
It was definitely another change. Mm-hmm. You know, my life changed when I got sober. Mm-hmm. You know, my life changed, you know, when I did my first meditation, you know, which was 3 years before I got to Agape. You know, but it was what led me to that spiritual expansion. Mm-hmm. You know, and then when I got to Agape, yeah, a whole another level of awakening to what was possible and who I am happened. And then, you know.
And for people who don't know, Agape is a big church in Los Angeles that's very metaphysical, consciousness oriented. It's huge, isn't it?
Yeah, it's huge. It's about 10 to 12,000 people strong, multicultural, spiritual center. It's called Agape International Spiritual Center of Truth, and Michael Beckwith, mm-hmm. Was featured teacher of The Secret, and you know he's been on a lot of talk shows and has his own books out called Spiritual Liberation and Transcendence and the Life Visioning Process, and he's just an amazing, amazing mystic and teacher, mm. And he's been my teacher for 20 years.
Wow! So you started going and you just kept going and you became quite a participant, didn't you?
Yeah. Yeah, I became licensed there, the licensed therapist, and that's my home.
Do they have a system for licensing therapists, the people that are like
you?
You
go to classes for about 5 years, like college.
But they don't have a college through Agape, do they?
No, they don't.
Okay. So you do workshops. Like, tell us about your online groups. You do 12-step programs online in your Soul Recovery program?
I do the Soul Recovery.
The kind that's outlined in your book, right?
The kind that's outlined in my book. I take people through the process for 10 weeks. Mm-hmm. And if they are then interested after going through the 10 weeks for their own evolution, their own spiritual growth, then we have a 4-week course after that if they want to move on and become a Soul Recovery coach.
Well, that's wonderful. And Soul Recovery coach is somebody who takes people through these keys, is that right?
Yes.
Wow. And so yeah. Are and they then, like sponsors yeah. as well?
No, well, we call forth people that are sponsors, ministers, therapists, anyone in that field of service where they want to incorporate Soul Recovery, life coaches, that where they want to incorporate the Soul Recovery principles in the work that they already do. Mm. Sponsors are usually people that are out of, you know, the anonymous programs, and they're your sponsor to be of maximum service, solely to be of maximum service as a part of their program. Whereas being a therapist is like, that's your profession. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we invite people that if you want to, you know, add this on as your career, mm-hmm. that there's an opportunity to do that.
Wow, that's wonderful. So I'm really interested in back to forgiveness. You said you do forgiveness workshops. What would people expect if they should come to one? Or
they,
two or three?
What they would expect to do is to first get really clear about the resentments that they are aware of and that they're not aware of. There are a lot of people that come to my workshops, it's like, I don't know why I'm here. I've really dealt with all of my resentments and I don't really have any resentments. And I'm like, okay, give me 15 minutes. And then they're like, oh my God, I have like 20 resentments. I didn't even know that was still there and still bothering me. So they'll become aware of that energetic that's weighing them down as as resentments. They will be dealing with their inner child and their core woundedness. They will be re-identifying themselves as expressions of light, renegotiating their spiritual contracts with the people that they believe have hurt them, which we call those people your angels disguised as your enemies. And we do emotional freedom technique to really get in there.
That's the tapping and so on. Hey?
I'm sorry?
That's the tapping?
Yeah. You know, and we do some Sedona method, which is releasing resistance. So there's a lot of energy that is released in my workshops. A lot of healing has happened in those workshops.
And do you go to them yourself?
And you also get to look at your part of the street, your side of the street, and make amends if that's necessary, because that's also a huge part of setting yourself free. Is you facing your stuff and cleaning up your side of the street.
I like that, your side of the street. I kept reading that thinking that's a very good line. It's like stop more. Because here's so often we hear, well, if you keep releasing people, they will like you again and that sort of thing. And you're saying that's not your business, actually.
That's not your business.
No.
You could go to someone and make an amends and they'll be like, get the hell out of my face. I don't ever want to see you again. And your thing is, did I just clean up my side of the street to the best of my ability? And if the answer is yes, you can say, absolutely, I respect that. Take care. God bless. And walk away.
But you don't need to keep going back, yeah?
No. No, you don't. No.
But I think
once you've cleaned it up, you've cleaned it up.
So, okay, that's really interesting. Do you have any... first of all, I also want to say I really like what you've done with the book, and you've told us all to do the work, get really aware of things, and then write about it. Do you think writing is really, really important?
Writing is very important because there are things that come out on the paper that's just not happening in your head. And as you get things on paper, they just become more clear for you. I'm like, oh my God, I didn't even realize I felt that way, and there's that right brain, left brain kind of thing, you know, where things really have a chance to be revealed and expressed that you aren't even aware of. So journaling and writing is very important.
Yeah, I noticed looking at some of them, I thought, boy, I'm going to need 2-3 weeks to write on this section. Well, because it's like it's not just a, let's read this, because I was reading the book so I could talk to you. And I'm going, this is not a book just to be read. It's a book to be dived into and really been with, you know?
Yeah.
It's the book of me is what it is, right?
Yeah, I love that.
And you also have some wonderful quotes at the end. So a lot of this stuff is not necessarily, what I mean is it's not foreign to people, famous people through history like Goethe and people like that, eh? It's really very powerful. Where'd you get all those quotations? They're great.
It's ancient wisdom. I've read all those books.
Good for you.
You know, I've read those books, and each quote that I have in my book are quotes that I would underline and ponder and contemplate for my own spiritual journey and my own contemplation. And so when I was writing the book, I would immediately recall those because they meant so much to me.
Oh, they're really, really wonderful. I wish I had marked them off so I could quote some of them today. But they're really, behold, I make all things new. I love that.
Yeah, that's scripture.
Yeah.
You know, behold, I make all things new.
And
you know, isn't that the second step came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity.
Yes.
Behold, I make all things new, you know, so, yeah.
And then you have another one here by Joel. It says, I will restore to you the years that the locusts have eaten. And I love that because that's a kind of a deepening awareness that you haven't wasted your time, right? You have
right.
the ability to recover yourself.
It will be given back to you. When you reawaken to the truth of who you are, it will be given back to you better than you've ever imagined. Again, came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. Do you see how that, you know, scripture has been saying that all the time?
I
will restore the years the locusts have eaten.
And then there's another one. Truth is within ourselves, and to know consists in opening out a way whence the imprisoned splendor may escape. I love that because that's what you're saying too, isn't it?
Absolutely. That when you meditate and when you allow those five senses to quiet down, that there's a magnificence within you that now has space and room to express as the activity of your consciousness and in your world. But usually we block that with all of the chatter and the fears and the illusions and stuff. So, you know, when we can reconnect to that truth, you know, we make room for the inner splendor to be released through us. Yeah.
And so I want to go back. Before we end, I wanted you, if you wouldn't mind, to retell the story about being given the opportunity to sing, finally. This little girl who wanted to sing but never really got the opportunity.
Are you talking about at Agape?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I hadn't sung for 10 years, the first 10 years. 5 years of my drug addiction and the first 5 years of my recovery. Because I'd forgotten that I could sing. And
yet when you were little, you really wanted to, right?
That's all I did was sing, you know, when I was little, up until my drug addiction took off. You know, it's like I used to stand in front of my backyard, you know, with the hairbrush singing to my adoring fans, which were the trees, you know. And so it was always in me. It was always, a huge part of my identity. And so for the first, you know, for 10 years, I didn't sing. And then when I started to reawaken after 4 years, 5 years of sobriety, and I remembered all of a sudden that I was a singer. And that desire was reignited within me. And I said to my sponsor, I want to sing. Just out of the blue, I'm sitting in her car with her, like after a meeting, and I said, I want to sing. And she said, well, sing, baby. And, you know, I think I started going to vocal lessons, and I just started nurturing that part of myself that had been long forgotten. And then I showed up at Agape one day, and I'm sitting in the audience, and we're all singing, you know, one of the most famous Agape songs, I Release and I Let Go. And I'm singing it, not thinking I'm singing louder than anybody else. And Ricky Byers-Beckwith, who's Michael Beckwith's wife, who's the musical director there, looks over at me from the stage and mouths to me, I want to talk to you. And I point at myself and I'm like, me? You know, I don't know you. I want to talk to you. And so afterwards, she says, she's sitting at her piano and she says, I want you to sing this song a little bit for me. And I did. And she says, I have a song for you. And that's like huge at Agape. You have to be a member there for 6 months to even get in the choir, let alone get a solo.
Mm.
And I wasn't even auditioning for a solo or trying to get into the choir. And so I just believe that higher part of me had gone before me to make the crooked places straight and to restore to me the years that the locusts have eaten.
Wonderful. Yeah, it made me almost cry. I go, yeah, because we forget that we don't forget. You made it conscious that those rewards, those recognitions come to us, the real us.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
That was really precious. This is a wonderful, wonderful book, everybody, called Soul Recovery, 12 Keys to Healing Addiction. And it's been delightful talking to you, Esther Nicholson.
Thank you. And let them know that, you know, they can go to www.soulrecovery.org to get the book and to get any information on this teaching.
Yes, and also to sign up. You've got workshops coming up.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Do you travel?
Oh, yeah. No. I travel quite a bit, and I'll also be facilitating a retreat on the grounds of Unity Village called the Awaken Life Center, a retreat for 2 days on Make Room for the for Miracles, a forgiveness retreat, forgiveness workshop.
Wonderful.
We're also going to party, too. So anyone who wants to do that, you know, at the end of this month, go to soulrecovery.org. It's right on the homepage, the Awaken Life Center retreat that I'll be facilitating at the end of this month.
And that's the 27th to the 29th. And is that in L.A.?
Yeah. That's in Kansas.
In Kansas. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, this
yeah.
is really exciting. I saw that little blurb and I thought, wow, because I can't make that distance. But one day on these online classes will be very exciting. Isn't that great about the computer? You can be everywhere at once.
That is true. Yeah.
Well,
and I'll be speaking at Agape sometime in October. So if you're there, then I'll let you know. Or
that would be absolutely wonderful. Love to come and hear you. I don't always get to L.A., but maybe.
Okay. Very cool.
I thank you so much. I've really enjoyed your book and talking to you and the amount of spiritual energy that's just run through in this discussion and in this book and in your work. Thank you so much, Esther.
Thank you, Veronica. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, you're
welcome. I appreciate
you. I appreciate you.
Blessings.
Blessings. That was Esther Nicholson talking about Soul Recovery 12 Keys to Healing Addiction. That's addiction of all kinds, whether it's shopping, whether it's drugs and alcohol, whether it's food, whether it's a time thing or money, it doesn't matter. She was just really inspiring, and you can tune in to her with soulrecovery.org. And this is Veronica Entwistle saying, tune into my website, veronicaantwistle.com. Love to hear your feedback. Press the Ask Veronica button. Many, many blessings, and thank you for listening.